95% of all fiber artists are women. Women, says Fairbanks artist Fran Reed, grow up around threads and yarns and are expected to learn to knit at the age of 10. It's a natural art form to be attracted to, though few women take that childhood attraction to the extent that Reed has. Since graduating with a degree in art education from the University of Oregon in 1967, Reed has exhibited and sold her work quite widely, in Alaska and in the lower 48. Her work is included in the collections of the Alaska State Museum in Juneau, the Alaska Contemporary Art Bank, and is on display at the Juneau Courthouse and the Nolene Library in Fairbanks.
There's phases that I've gone through, and I was really into doing very thick weaves that were very warp-faced and hand-dyed and colors blending throughout the whole thing, with wool rovings in the weft and big gooey kind of things. And then and now I'm more into working with just the color and the and two techniques. And I'm presently just starting on this series that I'm going to do that will be color. One wall hanging will be brown, one will be green, one will be yellow. You know, they'll all hang together. There won't be blends of browns and greens and reds and blues in one wall hanging. They'll be all predominantly one color. And the technique will change and the design will change.
It's unusual to use more than one technique in a piece, she says, to combine, say, flossa and log cabin, rather than doing an entire wall hanging in either of the two.
Are most of your things wall hangings rather than functional items? Yes.
Why?
Yes. I am bored to death doing textiles.
Textiles, such as yardage and placemats, don't interest Reed, nor does the handwork required to finish such items. She used to do off-loom weaving in the days before she could afford her own loom, but seldom does that anymore except to incorporate off-loom techniques into her woven work.
A lot of the fiber artists up here use natural materials in their work. Dog hair, grouse feathers, bark, whatever. Do you tend to incorporate other materials in work? No. I shy away from it mainly because so many other people are doing it. And I think in a way it's a cop-out. I think it's really a short-lived interest to, for instance, hand-spun dog hair and hand-woven on little backstrap looms and all of this sort of thing. But if you're going to be serious about it, you financially cannot spend that amount of time spinning, perhaps dyeing, and then weaving it up, and then expect to get any price out of it. When you do sell your work, about how much an hour do you think you're probably going to pay? Including getting the materials together, all the way through to presentation form. It really, really varies. On one wall hanging, it might be figured I might make $20 a square foot, and on another it might be $100 a square foot. Depends on the type of yarn, the technique that I'm using, whether it's been hand-dyed, and this sort of thing. I think the most I've received is $20 an hour for weaving.
And down to what, free?
Not quite free. No, I would say, you know, somewhere around $2 or $3. You've been in Alaska 10 years now. Do you feel that your art is Alaskan? Has being in the state influenced your work? I'm sure it has, just because I live here in the white snow and the, you know, the birch trees and whatnot. As a matter of fact, what I'm working on now is a birch influence. And this is the dark brown on the bottom and then the light nubs of the branches falling down. And they're all working in the block system that I have on the log cabin.
Log cabin is a weave that resembles the ridges of a log cabin.
Oh, one of the things that I love about weaving is the therapy of the noise of the loom. It really is. It was the first thing that ever caught my eye on this whole thing. And there's a lot of looms that are made that don't make any noise, and I don't see how anybody could stand to weave on them. I love the noise. Is there anything that you find frustrating about weaving? A broken thread. I don't find anything too frustrating. It's the therapy involved that I feel from just sitting here going back and forth is really nice. And I pace it out just so that I do this back and forth business to a certain point, and then I stop and do a different technique in there. And so it breaks up a little bit of the monotony of going back and forth, which would happen if I were doing textiles.
Do you make your designs with that in mind, lack of boredom?
Yes, I really do.
Not that Reed worries about boredom. She feels that this could be her second year of making a profit on her work, work that the artist, who was born in California in 1943, hopes to continue into old age.
Do you want to be an old lady weaver?
Sure.
I'll be dead at my loom at 95.
Fran Reed, Fairbanks fiber artist, alive at her loom with at least a few years to go. I'm Karen McPherson in Fairbanks.
When he was only three, I'm singing, Davy, Davy Crockett, king of the wild frontier.
Once again now, Davy.
Alaska is called the last frontier, and appropriately we have our modern-day Davy Crockett. Not necessarily the patch up the crack and the Liberty Bell types, but people who dress in buckskins or imitation buckskins and shoot muzzle-loaded rifles. People like John Nielsen of the Midnight Sun Moose Hiders and Muzzleloaders Association. You have an interesting outfit on. Does this have anything to do with the effectiveness with which you fire the gun?
No. It's part of the, again, part of the history, and I guess the flavor of the sport is wearing some of the apparel that was contemporary with the weapons.
What period of time are we talking about?
We have a number of guns here representing different time periods. The oldest weapon here is the British Brown Bess. Revolutionary War era weapon, and going up through the percussion weapons of the middle 1800s up to the turn of the century.
Loading one of these weapons is not as simple as your modern day Remingtons with neat boxes of bullets that are quickly inserted into a chamber. These rifles aren't called muzzle loaders for nothing.
The soldier took a cartridge from his cartridge box, tore off the lip of the cartridge and poured a pre-measured powder charge down the barrel. Then he dropped his, in this case, a 75 caliber round lead ball down the barrel. The rest of the cartridge would go on top of that, and then the whole charge would be rammed down and seated in the breech. The rest of the cartridge was put in the gun to prevent the ball from simply rolling down the barrel if the muzzle was depressed. But then the hammer would be pulled back, and the what's called the pan would be charged with powder, and the frizzen, a cover, would be closed over the pan, and then the weapon is ready to fire. It could be pulled back to a full cock and discharged by the flint striking against the frizzen, throwing a shower of sparks, which would ignite the charge in the pan, which would in turn ignite the charge in the breech, and the weapon would fire.
Is that dangerous to do?
Not particularly, if you know what you're doing and you're careful about it. It is very temperamental, though, much more so than modern weapons, you can imagine. A little bit of humidity in the air or anything like that can affect the discharge. And if you're not careful, sometimes if you tip the weapon, the powder will fall out of the pan.
Even with that complex procedure, British Revolutionary soldiers were expected to get off 3 shots a minute on Brown Bess, which is a flintlock. The percussion rifle used by the mountain men of the mid-1800s differs slightly in the loading procedure.
The percussion cap is put over a nipple, which is right at the base of the breech. And when the hammer strikes that nipple, the percussion cap is what ignites the main charge in the breech.
Once the weapons were loaded, they were deadly.
These weapons were not intended to be accurate beyond 50 yards. Of course, they could kill a man easily at 100 yards. But the ignition system and the loading and so forth, which was all done by more or less by command, was a 10 or 11 count process. If you opened fire with this weapon at, say, an advancing enemy in 100 yards, you might, by the time you got off the last of your three shots, the enemy would be within perhaps 20 paces. And at that point, the weapon was devastating because throwing a 75 caliber ball, you had tremendous shock power. And of course, the front, it looks like a sight on this weapon, was used primarily as a bayonet lug. And of course, all the weapons were usually were fixed with bayonets. And at that point, the general melee took place. And but the fire actually was simply for shock effect. And there were real drawbacks to that. This is as an accurate weapon.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever shot an animal with one of these guns?
I have shot small game, rabbits and such. I've never taken a large animal such as a moose, although friends of mine have. With they're just as effective as modern weapons.
Though hunting is not the primary use for the guns, it's a sport where muzzle-loading enthusiasts shoot at targets or engage in a competition called a primitive, where competitors shoot at metal silhouettes.
A shooter will be asked to start out with a loaded weapon, and there'll be four or five different stations where these animals will be set up at different ranges on, say, wooden stumps. And upon his taking his first shot, he's then timed. He has to run the entire course shooting these silhouettes in field conditions. These are, again, all at different ranges, so it's a lot of skill involved. And then perhaps at the end of that course, he has to come back and lay his rifle down and throw a tomahawk into a stump.
Sort of a modern-day muzzleloaders, cowboys, and Indians, and mountain men like John Nielsen. I'm Karen McPherson in Fairbanks.
Liberty Bell, let's sing and day.